Good morning. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, everyone. The first order of business is approval of the minutes, and we have two sets of minutes. One is January 25th, and the other is February 15th. And we do have a quorum. So does anyone care to move the January 15th?
Madam Chair.
25th minutes, I'm sorry.
I make a motion to move those minutes.
Are you moving the January 25th?
January 25th.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes of January 25th? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of January 25th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And then the February 15th minutes?
Madam Chair. I'll move the approval of the February 15th minutes.
Okay, very good. Approval of the February 15th minutes. Any discussion to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the February 15th minutes are approved. Thank you, everyone. Okay. The first order of business, the only order of business today really, is to have a walkthrough of the recently released report, the Millman Public Option Report. I'm going to just start by saying that the purpose here, we're not taking public testimony, as everyone knows. We have had some things submitted to the to committee members, and we are posting those on our committee website. So for members of the public, if you wish to see comments and things that have been submitted to the committee, they are on our website, and members have received them directly by email. And then the other thing I'm going to say is that we're going to, I assume, spend some considerable time asking questions and getting answers to questions, and I'm going to just try my best to let as many members as possible ask questions. So I just want to say up front, we're going to please hold questions until the end, unless it's a very quick clarifying question. We've done that before. And we're going to use the speaker list as we normally do. But I'm going to ask members to just ask one question at a time with maybe a quick follow-up, and then we'll go to another member so that we can kind of give everybody an opportunity, and I'll try to be fair among the parties. And, you know, as I told Representative Schumacher, if you feel I'm not being fair, let me know, but my intention is to let everyone ask questions. And we'll see how far we get. Also, before we get started, I'd like to introduce our new committee page, Natalie Wavra, I think it is. Wavra, very good. Well, welcome, Natalie. We're very happy you're here. I can't see you, but there you are. So good. We finally have a committee page, and really glad to have Natalie. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Peter Brickwitty and go ahead and give your presentation. Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. Thank you to you and members. I'm looking forward to the discussion today. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Dreyer, to lead through the presentation, and then we'll be happy to take questions.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Julia Dreyer. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Insurance at the Department of Commerce. Our vision for fair and equitable markets in Minnesota are ones that meet the needs of all Minnesotans, and in particular Minnesotans who've been disadvantaged by our systems, to protect consumers and have businesses that are oriented towards business practices that eliminate unintended consequences for marginalized populations. This means commerce is protecting consumers against predatory practices in our marketplace, working to eliminate disproportionate impacts of industry policies on minority populations, ensuring that no Minnesotan is left behind as we transition to changes in our policy environment, and that we are equitably addressing various financial costs of any changes. As members know, one of Commerce's many roles is to serve as the state's insurance regulator. In the insurance space, We share regulatory responsibilities with our colleagues at the Minnesota Department of Health. We also work closely with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services and at MnSure on issues related to benefits and accessibility. Our overall goal is centering people in our healthcare policy decisions, striving for a system that is simple, accessible, equitable, and that one that eliminates economic barriers for people to access the care that they need. Last session, Commerce, along with the Department of Human Services, or DHS, was asked to conduct an actuarial study of what a public option could look like here in Minnesota. We contracted with Milliman, a national actuarial firm that has helped to conduct other states' public option analyses. We work closely with staff at DHS, MDH, and MnSure, along with legislative leaders and a variety of stakeholders to help shape the model. These stakeholders included consumer advocates, community organizations, health plans, provider groups, labor organizations, and representatives from the business community. Feedback from these stakeholders led to adjustments for variables such as the monthly premiums and cost-sharing levels, eligibility criteria, available benefits, and provider reimbursement levels. That report was published on February 1st, and as you are well aware, it's been very difficult to move conversations and discussions on the public option simply because we haven't had the right information to support those conversations. With this report, we do have additional information, but it really is just the first step, a puzzle outline versus a fully completed puzzle, but it does create some structure to help us figure out these other pieces. In addition to some of the terms defined in the glossary of the report, I just want to highlight a couple of key terms that we'll use quite frequently throughout the presentation. The legislature required us to examine different models, one of which was required to allow an option under which Minnesota Care continues to be administered as a basic health plan or the BHP. So when we use the word model, we mean the overall framework for the two concepts that were analyzed. So within each of these models, we have four scenarios, and those scenarios are the same in each model, Model 1 and Model 2. And we asked Milliman to compare scenarios with common major assumptions regarding reimbursement rates for providers and whether there was a subsidy limit for individuals or not. So when we refer to a specific scenario, we mean that set of assumptions within that model. And so for reference, members can refer to Table 1 on page 2 of the Milliman report. Again, as I stated, we looked at two different public option structures. Model 1 allows households with incomes above 200% of the federal poverty level, or FPL, to buy into a product that's identical to the state's existing Minnesota Care model. Model 2 establishes a qualified health plan, or QHP, at a platinum, gold, and silver level that would be sold on MnSure, the state's health insurance marketplace. This version of a public option would allow Minnesotans, again with incomes over 200% FPL, to purchase a platinum level QHP that closely resembles what's available by Minnesota Care, both in terms of the benefits covered and what people have to pay towards their medical costs. In this model, people would also be eligible for federal or state premium subsidies. In both structures, the public option is available to anyone who has to buy insurance on their own. It makes roughly over $330,000 for a household of one, or $60,000 for a household of four. So that's that 200% FPL. The universe of that population is projected to be just a little under 500,000 people. So that is the combined individual market, so people who buy on MnSure, people who buy directly from health plans as an individual product, and those people who are uninsured. Both models, in general, increase the value of people's insurance. In general, this means more benefits, lower premiums, and lower out-of-pocket costs. Both models are delivered by health plans. It's really the oversight and the structure of that delivery that is a little bit different. It's also important to note that neither model impacts the eligibility, operations, or structure of the Minnesota Care program for existing Minnesota Care enrollees. Again, Milliman examined four different scenarios within each of these models, and these scenarios vary how much providers are paid, offering options at current Minnesota Care reimbursement levels and Medicare reimbursement levels. The scenarios also offer options for what people enrolling in a public option would pay. So One is looking at the subsidy limit. So that's similar to the current expanded subsidies that are available to people on MNsure right now due to the American Rescue Plan, or ARPA. And this limits premium contributions to roughly 8.5% of income. The second is looking at that 400% of the federal poverty subsidy limit. And that is under the Affordable Care Act, people with incomes above 400% FPL were not eligible for premium subsidies. And this is the subsidy limit that will be in effect again in 2026 with the expiration of the expanded ARPA subsidies. And again, 400% FPL is roughly $60,000 for a household of one and almost $125,000 for a family of four. Looking at the two models, Milliman estimates that the annual cost to the state to run Model 1 is between $113 million and $364 million, and between $86 million and $187 million in Model 2. That full cost of running the program is higher, but part of this cost is shared by enrollees through the premium contributions and through the federal pass-through funding generated by savings. And those savings are based on the amount the federal government would have spent on advanced premium tax credits. Milliman also estimates that between 107,000 and 151,000 Minnesotans would choose to enroll in a public option. This analysis is intended to provide directional information on what level of state financing is needed to fund the program annually and how that level of needed funding may change depending on how the program is structured. Decisions on how to structure, set up, and maintain the operation of the program all contribute to the overall costs of standing up and running a public option in Minnesota.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I thought you were done with your sentence. I just wanted you to, if you could just pause on this for a second and just clarify, because this is kind of a foundational slide, and just clarify whose costs we're talking about, which costs we're talking about here, because the slide doesn't, I don't think.
Sure. So these costs would be the cost to the state to pay for people's insurance or to pay for those people's medical bills. It does not include the state's operational and administrative costs. So it doesn't include the cost to implement and sustain the program or, you know, to pay for setting up an IT infrastructure, paying for staffing at the agencies, that sort of
so
thing.
So these are annual costs to the state.
And these are annual costs to the state.
Thank you. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Thank you for the question. This is a more detailed version of what we just discussed. So this is looking at Model 1, so the Minnesota Care version, so the buy-in. Under Model 1, that buy-in framework, Milliman estimates between 107,000 and 144,000 people will choose a public option over a typical qualified health plan on the exchange. It's also assumed that these individuals choosing the public option are either currently enrolled in a plan via, like, through MNsure, either or have an individual market policy that they purchased off exchange, or that they're uninsured. And so this particular chart looks at the breakdown in per member per month costs. So that's like a smaller version. So in general, what's driving the differences in the costs are differences in reimbursement levels. So the first two columns assume the current basic health plan or Minnesota Care reimbursement levels, which is approximately 83% of Medicare. And the second two columns assume Medicare reimbursement or 100% at 100%. Additionally, the costs are slightly lower in scenarios 1B and 1D because of the subsidies cap out at 400% of that federal poverty level. And that means fewer people, and typically those who are older or who are higher income, are choosing to enroll. And again, that state funding does not mean the full state costs. Can you go to the next slide? So again, this is rolled up, so same chart, but looking at the annual costs to the state instead of the per member per month costs. A couple things I want to point out. Milliman estimates that the federal pass-through funds are roughly the same in each scenario of Model 1, so $328 million. That's because they assume that the differences in the model are largely driven by the uninsured or unsubsidized populations, neither of which generate pass-through funds using the federal calculation. Again, this chart shows the state funding to pay for people's insurance or care and doesn't reflect the full fiscal cost of running the program. The last line shows the margin or the marginal costs, and that helps to account for unknown contingencies like healthcare innovations, changes in prescription drugs, that sort of thing. looking at Model 2, this is a similar chart per member per month by funding source, but it reflects the QHP framework. And again, we're assuming between 135 and 151,000 people are enrolling in this coverage. The cost of the public option is similar between the two models, between Model 1 and Model 2, but it's the average. But the average premiums are a little bit higher, in large part because of who is buying the public option in this particular scenario. Can you go to the next slide? Okay. Thanks. Again, the state funding for providing this coverage is between, for Model 2, is between $86 million and $187 million. In Model 2, people are receiving both a federal premium subsidy, like they do today, but the state is also paying an additional subsidy that helps wrap around that federal subsidy and lowers people's premium costs, and it allows them to buy a higher value product. There are differences in the ways that the state could choose to apply that subsidy, but in the model, Milliman assumes that the state subsidy wrap would only apply to those people purchasing a premium level plan. All of these numbers, I think, are really sometimes difficult to understand in abstract. So Milliman did put together a couple different scenarios. This is from table seven or page 25 of the report, and it looks at a hypothetical situation. There are a couple other hypothetical situations at the very end in the exhibits of the report. So this particular individual is at just at 201 of the federal poverty limit, so just over that eligibility criteria to be eligible for Minnesota Care Today. They are 33 years old and reside in the Twin Cities metro area. Assuming that prior to the public option, this person enrolled in a bronze plan on MnSure. So in 2027, when this theoretically is in effect, this person is choosing between a bronze plan or choosing to enroll in the public option. If they picked a bronze plan, the premium would be just a little under $375 a month. So that's 1A. But they'd be eligible for a federal subsidy tax credit of $185, meaning that they would pay just a little over $189 a month. Again, this is a bronze plan, so it has an actuarial value of 60%, meaning that the person is responsible for 40% of all the costs of all the covered benefits. This generally means they have a higher deductible and higher cost sharing. If they picked the public option, their premiums would be higher, so $459 a month, but they would be eligible for premium support from the state, and this means they'd be paying $107 a month, but paying for a plan with a 94% actuarial value. So that combined improvements and or value improvement is roughly $274. So looking at the same person in Model 2, if they pick the bronze plan, their premium, again, would be just a little under $375. The tax credit is a little different in this situation. It's almost $42 because of how the calculations work on the federal government side. In this model, the second lowest cost of the plan or that plan that's used to calculate that federal tax subsidy is a little bit different. If they pick the public option, their premiums again would be higher at almost $400 a month, but they would be eligible for a combined version of the federal subsidies plus an additional $250 in state subsidies. So again, they'd be paying $107 a month and paying for a plan with, a 94% actuarial value. So there's an increase in value of an improvement in their plan. Although both of the models examined by Milliman suggest that a public option would improve access to lower cost care, the report does not, as we mentioned before, capture the full fiscal impact of the state or the healthcare system more broadly. Both models would significantly change how state agencies, namely Commerce, DHS, MDH, and MnSure, serve Minnesotans. And questions about how our respective agencies would do that was outside of the scope of the Milliman analysis, but should be considered as part of any final proposal. While this report provides a framework for advancing a public option, there are still many critical decisions that need to be made before we be in a place to be able to request federal pass-through funds from our federal regulators. And I want to underscore that these decisions are multifaceted and carry with them risks that could destabilize different parts of the market. Additionally, while the report projects potential costs to pay for health coverage, it does not analyze options for the source of the state's payments or suggest additional revenue streams. Finally, there are a handful of issues that in our recommendation letter that we recommend that the legislature consider as they strongly impact the relative success of the public option. The first of these is looking at how the public option would address existing health disparities by race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, immigration status, and geographical location. It's important to understand how both the benefits of the public option extend to Minnesotans as well as the potential risks. In particular, we would encourage the legislature to examine how the two public option models will impact providers and their ability to both continue to serve those currently enrolled in a Minnesota healthcare program as well as those who choose to enroll in a public option plan. The Milliman analysis also addresses the necessary guardrails for Minnesota to be eligible for federal funding. We also assumed a relative reasonable interpretation of existing federal guidance that would hold the state harmless for federal funds received to support the current basic health plan or Minnesota Care. However, further conversations with federal officials is definitely needed to be able to understand how a public option would impact current federal funding sources. Each of these models also assumes that MNsure would continue to be available to help people shop, compare, and choose a health plan. However, both of the models impact how MNsure would work. And in particular, Model 1 would significantly impact MNsure's revenue stream. And it's important to ensure that the state adequately fund this source and the support. Similarly, both models require an IT build and changes to IT platforms, and costs would depend on the specification of these changes and the timing of revamping those necessary eligibility and enrollment systems. Again, the costs in this paper are shown as one-year costs, so additional modeling will be needed to fully complete the 10-year projections and other analysis needed to complete a 1332 waiver for federal pass-through funds. And finally, both of these models change how our state agencies work, and we need to account for any significant changes in staffing and staff expectations. And again, what this looks like depends on the model and other policy decisions. Finally, there are many changes between now and 2027 that will impact the relative success of the public option model. First, there are several key changes that will happen in 2026 that will likely impact the number of people enrolled in the individual market. Specifically, the expiration of the federal advanced premium tax credits and the state's reinsurance program will result in many people in the individual market seeing significant premium increases. Large premium spikes tend to result in people choosing to go without insurance, decreasing the number of people in the individual market. Federal pass-through funds are based on the number of people in the individual market receiving advanced premium tax credits, so significant decreases in the individual market enrollment could diminish federal funding to support any changes associated with implementing a public option. Second, the Milliman analysis only examines current Minnesota Care rates and Medicare reimbursement rates. This is less than what providers are currently being reimbursed at for patients currently enrolled in an individual market plan. And every single conversation we had with stakeholders raised the need to address provider reimbursement rates to ensure that providers, particularly those who are part of a primary care team, or those who already care for a large number of Medicaid populations aren't adversely impacted. And as noted in the previous slide, understanding the impact of providers also has implications for things like how quickly Minnesotans are able to see a doctor and how far they have to drive to access certain services. Third, as we know from past experience, making sure people know about a program and that they have adequate support to be able to understand their options is critical to ensuring that Minnesotans are able to enroll in the public option and that they are able to get help with any questions they have after they enroll. The two models presented in the report would require different enrollment paths for people to shop, choose, and enroll in a plan, and would require different types of post-enrollment support, such as establishing a call center, handling consumer complaints, appeals, and so forth. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate that this study highlights an exciting opportunity for Minnesota, but a successful implementation is predicated on filling in the rest of the puzzle with thoughtful and well-considered decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let me just say, you know, thank you to the team that has worked on this. I think it's been extraordinarily quick work. We dropped a lot on your lap last session and said, do it yesterday. So, and you all did come through, and Milliman came through for us. And so I know everyone's read every word of that report. I have to say, it took me a whole day to get through it. I couldn't just read it cover to cover, and you know how much I absolutely retained, I couldn't say. I hope there's no quiz, but maybe this was the quiz. I don't know. But anyway, I am kind of wondering when our list is going to start populating, because I haven't had. Oh, there we go. First question. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I confess, too, I have not read every single letter in this report, but I have studied it over, and it is a lot to absorb, and I think we're all going to be looking at it for a while. I did want to say I think I'm missing the last page, page 57, where you tell us what we should be doing now. But you can email it to me. That would be helpful. So I have a few questions, but we can go one at a time as the chair suggested. So the first question I have is that I noted in the report that in these scenarios that APTC and reinsurance are not considered. They go away. So my question is, can the state hold and utilize two 1332 waivers at the same time based on what happens in the near future between reinsurance or APTC if there's further changes, or is this a factor of the PTF in some way, the pass-through funding?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative, great question. The state can have, let me answer your question in two parts. First of all, page 57 is contained in the other document, the cover letter that has recommendations.
To the Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Bierman, a state can have one 1332 waiver. But a 1332 waiver can do multiple things. So the report, Milliman assumes current law. So because the report assumes a 2027, plan year 2027 implementation, under current state law, we have not appropriated funding for the reinsurance program in 2027. So it assumed that it does not exist under current law. I would posit that reinsurance and a public option are not mutually exclusive. That is a public policy choice that the legislature needs to make about whether or not it wants to operate one or the other or both.
Okay, thank you very much. And are we still on one question on that?
You can have a brief follow-up, I
brief
think,
follow-up?
Representative Bierman.
Okay, thank you. So with that, I just wanted to, in the report, there's a sentence that I have pretty close. The scenarios show that some program parameters can be adjusted to reduce costs, but overall program costs remain at a similar magnitude and across various models and scenarios. So my question is, can we presume that costs may be similar, but the key is that more people will have better coverage and will be able to afford the health care that they need?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I think the spectrum of costs, and again, the costs that are shown in the report are a presumed one-year view of the costs of the providing the health care and did not assume the full state costs, as Deputy Commissioner Dreyer was speaking to earlier. But I think that's part of why we tried in the presentation and are contained in the report to illustrate some hypothetical scenarios to understand what the price point for premiums might look like for a Minnesotan who might be interested in purchasing a public option, should it be available, and also to understand the value proposition of what that Minnesotan would be getting out of their plan. So the examples that we showed earlier in the slide presentation kind of illustrate that value proposition between buying something that would have a 94% actuarial value versus someone purchasing a 60% actuarial value bronze plan. The price point on premiums is I think, seen to be pretty good. And the value that you're getting, the amount of coverage that you're getting, and how you may access that care is also improved in the analysis.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And would like to have, and you can probably have to give me this offline, better understanding the assumptions and calculations in the background. I noticed that when you came up with 192.26 improved benefits, that's assuming $6,785.65 annually. But I'd like to also understand what you used as the reimbursement rate comparison between private and public coverage and that the effects that are inherently then projected onto the hospitals. So, you know, you've got additional parameters of where you've used assumptions on, and if you can just fill that in offline, then I can understand exactly what type of impact onto the hospitals for their financial stability due to this shift. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Representative Kwan, we'd certainly be happy to follow up with you offline. I will note, and we referenced it, table one on page two of the report document is a quick summary of the major assumptions about reimbursement to provider amounts. And I would note that it's not, the Milliman analysis does not just look at hospital reimbursement, but also reimbursement to all providers. There are assumptions kind of under the hood along there as well. So the major sort of toggle is the difference between existing Minnesota Care reimbursement amounts and 100% of Medicare. And so you can see which scenario within each model has those reimbursement assumptions.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the quick follow-up is that we have more than Minnesota and Medicare. We have private coverages. And when you look at the analysis of a bill and what they're paying, what they're saying the hospital is allowed to charge, and et cetera, that variability is broader than the two that you mentioned. And that's why I want the whole global. So please help me understand what you used for assumptions for the whole global and not just cherry pick.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, the report only looks at reimbursement for this particular product. It does not examine the whole suite of impacts on providers. So that would be an additional analysis that we would need to do.
Representative Kwan.
Because you stated provider reimbursement rate comparison and the effects upon providers, I had assumed that you would look globally, because if we change the ecosystem, it's more than just these two. They're impacted, and we've got hospitals having issues at this time.
Right. Thank you, Representative Kwan. Mr. Brickwitty.
And Representative Kwan, you're certainly correct. There is I think we tried to touch on this in our report about what some of the things that need to be looked at going forward with this information in hand. And to the extent that there are movements from commercial reimbursement rates that are currently paid in the individual market to either the Minnesota Care reimbursement rates or something in between, for example, Medicare reimbursement rates, that would certainly have an impact. And I certainly wouldn't want to speak for providers on what that might look like. And I think the health plans would also have a perspective on that as well, too. I think what we were trying to reiterate is, for purposes of building this model, for informational purposes for the legislature in response to our assignment in Chapter 70 last year, we had Milliman assume the current Minnesota Care reimbursement rates and also 100% of Medicare. But you are correct, Representative Kwan, that is not necessarily reflective of the reimbursement rates that people in the individual market are covered or paying today.
Okay, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for all of the work and the presentation today. My understanding is that the model includes people who are from 2027 MNsure, individuals, an off exchange, and people who are uninsured, and not including any movement over from people who may have commercial coverage. I noticed in the executive summary that eligibility would include people who do not have an affordable offer of employer-sponsored insurance. That's on page one. And that to qualify as affordable, the employee's required contribution for the plan must not exceed 9.5% of the applicable taxpayer's household income. See, I even read the footnotes. My question is, do you have data that suggests that that would be a narrow enough slice that you didn't include it as part of the population? I don't have, could probably find it somewhere, but I don't know what share of people, say, in this small group market have unaffordable coverage, but what I hear from people is that many, many people can't afford their coverage or cannot afford adequate coverage. And so just interested in the decision not to include that in the analysis. Thank you.
Ms. Dreyer?
Madam Chair, Representative Breyer, so a couple things. So the affordable employer threshold is similar to what is required in the individual market today. So we use the similar sort of calculation. When we talked to Milliman about what happens to the employer market and like how many people who are currently in the employer market might move over to this sort of product, it was too speculative for them to actually model it out. So we just assumed that they just drew a line in the sand essentially and said there would not necessarily be an impact of people moving from, say, the small group market into the individual market. We do see movement back and forth now between those two markets, so safe to assume that there might be some, however.
Representative Breyer?
Thank you so much. I can understand the challenges of building that in. I wonder, though, if in a future step, to me, my concern is that understates the number of people who would be potentially enrolling in any of these options, because if you look at the two scenarios, it is so much better than what many people currently have, and I think that it would be very enticing for people to consider that. So if there could be even a zero, you know, X number, high, medium, low, built into some modeling so we could see that. And I would guess that maybe some of the employer benefit analyses that are done every year might be able to give us some insight into what's out there.
Mr. Brickwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Breyer, I think that's an excellent point. Two thoughts and follow-up. I think part of what makes viewing into 2027 somewhat extra complicated is what is scheduled to happen in 2026. Both at the state and federal level, and that the expiration of the expanded federal tax credits and the current state funding for the reinsurance program going away will certainly have an impact on those market dynamics as well. So I think that's part of why 2027 is hard to really look at there. And I also think that, and this is something that you will likely start to hear from us throughout the rest of the day, is there some public policy choices that the legislature could make about eligibility that would, if a bill were to move forward, advancing one or the other of these public option concepts, eligibility criteria could be opened or constrained to people who are currently in the group markets today. So there's an element of choose your own adventure from here, from the report. My kids have been checking out all the Choose Your Own Adventure books from the local library, so that's on my brain. But I think it fits here because the answer could be, well, we'll have no enrollment if the legislature were to structure the law that way, or we could have some enrollment if the legislature chose to open it up for people to buy into a public option product who are currently covered in group coverage. There are pros and cons to both, and we could help with the analysis there, but I think there is an element of that decision making from here with this as a baseline for informed decision making, hopefully, to get a better sense of what that impact might look like and how that would impact cost considerations for the state.
You good?
Yep.
All right, thank you, Representative Breyer. Okay, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Breyer. You just bought me another question because that was mine. I would like to explore just a little bit. I'm on page 4 of the actual study looking at the tables. I'm wondering why the assumption, so scenario 1A is that everyone can buy in and it's current reimbursement rates. Scenario 1C is that everyone can buy in, but there are increased reimbursement rates. So I'm specifically looking at 1A and 1C. And stop me if I'm wrong on that already. I spent a lot of time weeding through. I think I got it, but it's a lot. My question is, now the difference in premium on line E is $2. So there's virtually no difference in the cost of the premium, but there's a significant difference in the projected buy-in. So there's $144,000 in scenario 1A, $131,000 in scenario 1C. Why the significant discrepancy in that assumption?
Ms. Dreyer?
Madam Chair. So a couple things on for scenarios 1A and 1C, so for the no subsidy limit, mm-hmm. it's not that everyone can buy in, it's that there's that the subsidies are available to everyone, and those subsidies are capped at 8.5% of income. So the eligibility criteria are the same across mm-hmm. all four scenarios.
But we're, Madam Chair,
Representative Brinsley.
Just to clarify, we're still talking, though, about the same population.
Same population.
Yeah. Prior.
Yeah.
So the differences in the premium, and then I was trying to follow your numbers. So the premiums are roughly the same, but the differences might have to do with the differences in the take-up rates and who's choosing those plans and how the subsidies interact with that. So at that 400% threshold, more people who are higher income may drop out of the program altogether. Mm-hmm. So that's some of what's driving some of the differences in the numbers. I would need to dig into the specifics to get
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Which is why I'm comparing 1A and 1C, because theoretically we're talking about the exact same populations in those two groups. It doesn't have the 400% limit. So theoretically we're talking about the same groups. So that kind of thing would be important to understand. As a follow-up, we keep hearing that there will be increased coverage, better benefits, and I'm wondering, what are the assumptions there? What is the assumed coverage right now, and what mandate set are we assuming will apply to this new public option? So will the new mandate set be equivalent to the fully insured market right now? Would it be the same as Minnesota Care right now? Would it be the same as fee-for-service? Would it be PMAP? What benefit set are we assuming to make the assumption that everyone's benefits are going to be better?
Ms. Dreyer.
Madam Chair. The benefit set in Model 1 is assumed to be the same as Minnesota Care today, so the exact same benefit set. And Model 2 looks at a roughly equivalent benefit sets as well.
To
Minnesota Care.
To Minnesota. Okay.
Okay. All right. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some of these I think are going to be tougher. They may not be able to be answered because they may not have been part of the model, because it covers what the cost is to the state, but I'm trying to also get an understanding what else is the impact to the individuals as we're looking at this, because I know so often you're using the bronze plan as the basis for the individual, and that's got the actuarial value of 60% versus a platinum plan that has a actuarial value of 94%. So, and this is where my statistics and all that is off, so that's why I'm asking this part of the question. So that means under the bronze plan, an individual is paying much more out of their pocket for health care costs than they under the platinum plan. Why did you folks choose the bronze plan? Is that where most people are falling in right now?
Ms. Dreyer?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then for follow-up on that.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that means right now, so often we hear about the cost where people have to pay themselves, where we're seeing higher medical debt out there. We're seeing hospitals having to turn people over collections or having to write it off. So if all of a sudden we're moving up to 94%, that means a lot of costs that were on the individual before or being written off as charity care or as bad debt now ends up becoming covered in the process, correct?
Mr. Brickwitty?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, yes. generally speaking.
Generally speaking. So,
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So the question that comes in, and I think if I heard right, this was not calculated in the model, is how much more money then does that end up coming in for the hospitals, seeing that they're able to get more, you know, they're getting more coverage than they had before? I mean, you know, in theory, you're going to have less charity care, less bad debt. And then also, how does that, and I'm pretty sure the model didn't cover this, is what does that mean for a person's, you know, a person who's on the bronze plan now might have been paying high deductibles and all that is not captured in the premiums. Is there any way to know what that eventually means in their pocket at the bottom line?
So, Mr. Brickwitty. Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, let me split your question in two.
Please, yeah.
So the latter part first. The scenarios that were in our slide deck and that are contained in the exhibits at the end of the report try to get at answering or quantifying the answer to your question and trying to articulate what that value improvement is to a consumer's pocketbook bottom line. And it is projected to be significant between either Model 1 or Model 2 public option product and a bronze plan, or what we assume a bronze plan would look like in 2027. That is real savings, and I think that actuarial value captures the experience of the consumer and what they would actually pay towards their care when they need it, making that, I think, demonstratively more affordable. To your second question about reimbursement rates, I think, again, I want to stress that the model has hundreds of assumptions related to hundreds and hundreds of reassumptions generally, but lots of reimbursement assumptions, not restrained simply to hospitals, but to all providers. I think, you know, follow up to Representative New Brindley from a moment ago, some of the differentiation between the current QHP benefit set and what's covered under Minnesota Care, primarily vision and dental, but also some significant differences in mental health coverage. So I think the report does not get into, well, how would this hospital have its finances changed versus that hospital, and it does not do that across provider groups in full. I think you would need to probably speak to the providers themselves to get a sense of their perspective. I think one thing, and Deputy Commissioner Dreyer said this earlier, but I do want to reiterate it. I don't think there was a single stakeholder meeting that we heard from or we participated in the process of building this report where the people we were talking with one-on-one did not talk to us about provider reimbursement rates and the need to increase rates across the board. And that is that was across the ideological spectrum in a way that was surprising to me personally, to hear people who I generally in this building hear most often disagreeing, saying almost verbatim the same things to us about the need to increase provider reimbursement rates. So that's something that will have individualized impacts for different provider groups, and we did not specifically get into that analysis here in our report.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher, okay, very good. So if I could just expound on that for just a second. So I think that the issue here about how this would look for providers is complicated just by the fact that some of the people who might go into the public option are now on QHPs that pay presumably higher.
Right.
So there would be a reduction there, and then people who are uninsured, of course, now might be getting that charity care and so on, so that would maybe bring in more revenue that isn't there. And then people who have these bronze plans, you know, who knows how that plays out, right? So there might be more payment, there might be less payment, and I think that's kind of one of these things where we'd have to do this market analysis, and the report just doesn't speak to that, right? Just to be really clear mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. kind of to your right. question. Is that an accurate summary?
Madam Chair, I think it is. And I would add to it that obviously if we were to implement a public option, it would not happen in isolation. There are other public policy dynamics that would also be influencing the answer to Representative Fisher's question, both at a federal and state level. So I think it's a really important question, Representative Fisher. We just did not get into that level of analysis in this report.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just I'm trying to digest all of this. And so I think about enrollments, and my concern about critical access hospitals who are hanging by a thread or not even right now. And, you know, in rural Minnesota, especially in my agricultural world, there are a lot of people that do not have coverage or it's very expensive. And they just lost another policy situation that left. They just can't do that. So I'm wondering, what are these people going to do who are without insurance because of reinsurance or and the federal subsidies, ARPA, that end in 2026? I mean, what?
Well,
Mr. Brickwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, I think, you know, both here in Minnesota and across the country, there is significant interest in extending those subsidies for consumers, which I think have been demonstratively successful. They have been extended once already, and so that's a federal issue that I hope Congress will act on before they are due to expire in 2026. I think, you know, to your question about how and where will people access care, I think it's an important one. I think that is part of why, in our recommendations, we suggest that there should be some continued analysis on access and also doing an equity analysis, because there is, and we did, I think, go during the course of this project, start to see a little bit more clearly the potential for impact on not only the population who might buy this product, but also the existing Minnesota Care population groups, and not wanting to create any unintended adverse impacts on those individuals and their ability to access care when they need it on account of creating a public option product. And so I think that's part of the reason why the agency's recommended doing that further analysis moving forward. This is not a roadmap for exactly how the legislature should implement a public option product, but rather informing decision making going forward from here. And I think the questions that you're raising are important ones to make sure we address before we move forward or as we move forward.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, yes, I there needs to be a lot more analysis. I would be very, very concerned about the facilities in rural Minnesota. Just the fact that my, you know, in rural Minnesota anyway is elderly, and traveling to get the care you need might be non-existent. You just can't do it. Either the person can't travel or the challenges that are there. And I've had the privilege of being all over the state this year with other people's health care as well as my own, and have seen some real concerns about service and the need for that local service, whether it's hospital or clinic or, you know, providers. So I really urge that we are doing much more analysis about how this is going to function for us, or will it? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll pick up where Representative Fisher kind of left off about the bronze versus platinum issue. And just to get an example that I might help illustrate this. So in 2017, I was on a choice of ERISA plans and had an awful year. I was diagnosed with cancer and then shattered my right elbow in a bike accident. 1 year, had enormous bills. And I had signed up that year for a bronze type plan with my employer and regretted it. And so I went back and did a calculation of how much I would have saved if I had chosen the platinum plan that year instead, and was surprised to discover that I had actually minimized my out-of-pocket costs, because the combination of premiums plus out-of-pocket costs was actually still less under the bronze plan than under the platinum plan, because the platinum plan's premiums were so much higher. And I think one of the reasons why that is if you have a platinum plan, you consume more health care. And I can't tell from this, you know, how to what degree that went into the actuarial analysis of bronze plan versus platinum plan, but I think that explains partially what some of the risks involved are. So keep that in mind. I'm saying that I think that there's like, you know, the vector of three things that we need to understand better. I think this helps us with the actuarial part, but we, as this report says, we still need to understand, you know, how are we going to implement this? You know, one question I had would it be possible to use MNsure as the enrollment vehicle for option one, for example? If we have to set up a whole new claims adjudication system, what does that cost? And then the question that several members have raised is about, you know, what are we doing to provide our reimbursement rates on, as a whole?
Mr. Brickwitty?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I appreciate you raising some of the considerations about implementation on the state side, which are not contemplated in the report. I think your first question about, particularly in the case of Model 1, would a consumer buy a Model 1 product on MNsure is a really important foundational question for the consumer and what the customer experience would look like, but it's also a fairly existential question for MNsure as well, too. And so the decisions that need to be made, and I would encourage the legislature to sort of center the customer service experience in that process and in the design of a proposal to bring forward, I think you would see that that more complete fiscal cost projection from state agencies in a fiscal note on a bill once we've sort of chosen which adventure we want to start going down. But I think those are really important considerations, and I appreciate your comments about, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, but not trying to reinvent the wheel. I think those are helpful for us to sort of understand directionally which way the legislature would like to go, and then we can provide further analysis as state agencies in a fiscal note on a bill.
Representative Elkins?
Follow up in a little bit. You know, it standing up a claims adjudication system can be a pretty expensive venture. There's commercial off-the-shelf software to do that, but it's not cheap, and it's not simple to implement it. And that's something that we sometimes fall down on. We come up with these grand ideas and then fall down on the implementation. And if we're going to go down this road, we need to excel at the implementation as well.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nadell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for doing all this work and getting through here. Unlike Representative Bierman, I did read the whole thing. I'm joking. So I don't know how much more we can talk about the unknowns. There's so many. There's just so many assumptions that were made. So I think my first question, and hopefully Chair Liebling will indulge me to have an A on this, but can you talk a little bit, or can you provide us the baseline Medicare assumptions? You provided a lot of great data on the opt-ins, all right, and the options. But what I don't see is the baseline Medicare data on that underlying population. What we're building on is that available,
Mr. Brickwitty?
Madam Chair. Representative, I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking for sort of baseline understanding of the population that is currently covered in medical assistance or in Minnesota Care today, or are you looking for information about the population of people that the report projects might purchase a public option product?
No, I think you've done that. Sorry, Madam Chair. I think you've done that, the second part of that, fairly well. I mean, I'm looking at that underlying population that all this is based on.
Well,
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I would defer to my colleagues of the Department of Human Services to speak to the underlying population of Minnesotans who are utilizing public programs today, since they administer those programs. I think part of the reason, perhaps, I'm certain it's my fault, why I'm struggling with your question is that the population group that it would be purchasing this product is not necessarily people who are moving from the Minnesota Care population into a public option product. That could happen, some amount might, but it is, I think, projected primarily more to be individuals who are currently in the individual market or uninsured purchasing the public option product. So
Representative Nadeau, could you just ask your question again?
Yeah.
I also had trouble understanding what you were asking.
But that goes to my overall question with some of the assumptions. I don't think that the assumptions looked at the number of people that are going to move from employer-sponsored or commercial, you know, into the public market using the ICHRA. I mean, I think that, you know, we're creating, again, there's no real, I mean, healthcare is all about money, unfortunately. You know, I mean, that's what it is. And, you know, people get to make choices. We want them to do it. And if we subsidize or we build a model that, I mean, if we can get there and we build a model that, I think there is going to be a massive number of people that are going to move to, they're going to move because they can. And that's where I'm having a hard time getting my head wrapped around those baseline things of those populations. Again, I think that you've looked, I think that Milliman has looked at, you know, who they think is going to move over, but I just don't feel like this is sufficient in order for us to go on the adventure that you have referenced. That's a scary adventure. So my final question, Madam Chair, and thank you for indulging me. What do we need in order to be decent policymakers? What are the next steps that we need in order to make these decisions? Because we know that price controls for our providers is not the starting point. That is not it. And this assumes that. So what are those things that we need to know next in order to try to put a bill together? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Doe, asking agencies to tell us what we need to do to be decent policymakers? I don't know if I want to go there, but other than that, go ahead and answer the question,
well,
Mr. Equity.
Madam Chair, since Representative Nadeau is a former colleague from the Commerce Department, I know he's a decent public policymaker. I think the recommendations from the agency about Next Step are contained in the cover letter that it was included with the report. And I think I would boil it down very basically, that I do think that in order to get to a more complete fiscal analysis, the agencies need a bill upon which to create a fiscal note. And so there are some choices that are going to have to be, I think, made in the initial creation of a bill that can then be analyzed in the fiscal note and then also then refined through the legislative process. I think there are decisions that could be made. You referenced, for example, ICRAs, which are an opportunity for employers to provide funds to their employees to purchase more affordable coverage. We have seen interest in changes both here in Minnesota and across the country in the take-up on those types of products. And whether or not those individuals who are covered currently through an ICRA or another employer-based coverage, which is deemed to be affordable under the federal law, whether or not they would be eligible to purchase this is a public policy choice. And so, Representative, I think the report, and Deputy Commissioner Dreyer spoke to this earlier in response to a different question, it was difficult for Milliman to get to that level of assumptions because then there are assumptions on assumptions. I think if we get to the point where we've made kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down on whether or not those individuals, for example, would be eligible, that's a clear thing that we can then include in our assumptions on a fiscal note. I don't think it necessarily requires any additional analysis to make that thumbs up, thumbs down decision. It'll be better informed once we see that in a bill or we don't see that in a bill, because then we'll be kind of off of a one or the other option set, but we'll sort of be saying, okay, now this is the proposal in front of us. What does that look like? So I think there is some element of putting our foot in the ground and moving forward, and the agencies, I think, would welcome the opportunity to continue to work with legislators to understand what that full cost might look like, because this is just 1 year as well. So on an ongoing basis, I think understanding what those operational and implementation costs are, to Representative Elkin's question a moment ago, those are things that will have to be taken into consideration for as long as the state is operating a public option program, and the report just simply does not get into that level of detail.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is also about assumptions, so we're in a little bit of a theme here. And I do appreciate, as in any actuarial study, a lot of the assumptions you make are exceedingly cautious, which is what we wanted you to do. I just wanted to bring some light to some of these. Specifically, you include in all of the costs a 10% margin of an unknown cost, just to give a little buffer, which, again, I think is good, but is a cautious thing. On page 14 of the report, you recommend and clarify, again, correctly, that analysis of administrative and operational costs is outside of the scope of this report, which, again, I think is true, but also I think we need to remember that I think that savings cost is certainly a discussion when we talk about these sort of public option and public programs. All the N/A's of we don't know exactly what the federal subsidies will be on a PMPM for enrollees. We don't know exactly what they're going to do, so we have to assume what that lack is going to be. And then even with all of these, you know, the range of cost of, and I was speaking specifically of Model 1, that's the one I prefer to focus on, the cost to state is going to be between $113 million and $364 million per year, which is quite a big spread of potential cost. All of that to simply say is I do appreciate this report, and we've talked many times as you were compiling this report. I'm thankful for that. However, Rep. Nadeau just said a phrase that is sticking with me, a scary adventure. And I think the scary adventure right now is the state of health insurance in Minnesota. And
folks, we can't have any. I'm sorry, if you clap and things, I'm going to have to ask you to leave, so please don't.
So we are going to have to go into this unknown at some point, and I think you're giving us some really helpful models here and to help us and tools to go forward. But I think the status quo is something we cannot stay with. So all of this to get to a question. There's a question upcoming here. Is a positive assumption. Let's say that we do pass. I'm specifically thinking again of Model 1 for the point of this question, and it is successful. People, it's a popular program, and again, we are just given some very basic numbers for the first years of this program. So this is going to be a speculative question, but I think one important thing we need to remember about insurance is also that we are pooling risk. That's the whole point of this, is that we are all paying into this coverage so that we can bear it corporately together. So let's assume that this is a popular program, and let's assume that there's a high enrollment number in this, even higher potentially than is here. As Rep. Nadeau just mentioned, we don't really know exactly what those numbers are going to be. With an increase in enrollment, how do you see that a higher enrollment than assumed here? Ideally, in like a good insurance program, the more enrollment we get, the costs are actually going to be lower, or at least be able to be more broadly distributed. In your knowledge of this model, if those rates do increase in enrollment, is that going to be the case, or is that purely going to cause the cost overall of the program to rise with enrollment?
Who wants to take that? Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Smith, we could probably spend the better part of the rest of this time and our time in the other body where we're scheduled to present on the same topic at 12:30 talking about just your question. I think the answer is probably that it depends. I think one of the public policy choices before the legislature is how to consider the population, and it will depend a little bit on which model you wanted to pursue. So I know you just stated a minute ago that you preferred personally to kind of concentrate more on Model 1, but just for illustrative purposes, Model 2, which is understood to be a qualified health plan as individual market products are today, you may have different assumptions about whether or not those individuals who purchase the public option product are part of a single risk pool versus how they would be in Model 1. That's a public policy choice that the legislature could consider. And I think that impacts how the scenario that you have hypothesized here would potentially play out. I think there were assumptions that Milliman made about take up and utilization that are driving some of the cost figures here as well, too. That, you know, we know, I think our colleagues at the Department of Health and other public health entities who do surveys more regularly understand that people in Minnesota are struggling to use their health care, and that cost is a barrier to utilization. And so one of the, I think, the benefits certainly of the Minnesota Care product as it exists today is at that higher level of actuarial value and at a more affordable price, people are able to access care when they need it without cost being as much of a barrier as we see in the individual market. But I think it's difficult to get to a precise answer to your question because you are making a lot of assumptions to sort of get there. And so I think the answer is, the best answer we can probably give you is it would depend on a variety of assumptions, starting with sort of how you consider those people who have purchased a public option to be part of the risk pool or not.
Representative Smith?
Maybe I appreciate that. There's not going to be a clear answer to this question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just as a follow-up, as a sort of trying to define this. We're calling it a public option, but one of the big things about a public option is that the public will have the option to use it. And a lot of people, particularly those who are given insurance by their employers that are defined in the Affordable Care Act as affordable, will not have the option to be on this plan, right? That's just how our system is currently set up. If that were not the case, and this was a public option as, you know, traditionally defined, that anyone could be a part of it, would you, I assume the enrollment will just rise anyway, is that something that will make, in your opinion, this program untenable? Will it suddenly become too costly based on what you have provided for us? Or if more people got on, would it be something that the state could sustain? And I think that's a really important question as we go down this, is if enrollment goes up, can we sustain this? So I'm not maybe not asking very specifically, but in your opinion, having done this study, is it sustainable if enrollment rises drastically?
And maybe I could just, before Mr. Brickwitty struggles to answer that, because I know I kind of have an idea that that's a little challenging to answer. In your scenario, I suppose one of the big factors is whether the state can capture some of the money that employers are currently spending to support that insurance. If not, then we have a very different scenario than we would otherwise. But Mr. Brickwitty, now I gave you a moment to think about it.
Madam Chair, appreciate that. The answer will be the same. It will, I think, depend. And I think Representative Smith, the Milliman report gives us information that we did not have before. There have been any number of public option proposals previously before the legislature, but for the first time we have an actuarial study that can provide, I think, a baseline for more informed decision making moving forward. And yet, this is still only part of the cost structure. A more complete fiscal analysis will come in a fiscal note on a specific proposal. So those questions about sustainability, I think, are impossible to answer with just this information before you. I think, you know, DHS certainly could speak to this more eloquently than I could. Minnesota Care has become a bedrock part of our coverage spectrum here in Minnesota. It is something that works for the people who are on it and has found to be sustainable. There are certainly things that need to be constantly maintained in that process. Some of which would interlock with a public option product should it exist, some would not. I think part of why we are recommending an equity analysis is to better understand the impact of a program like this on the existing public program enrollee population, and we would not want to create something that would inadvertently create hardships or impact their ability to access care when they need it as well too. So. An unsatisfying answer, I'm sure, Representative Smith, but it is the best one that I think I have for you today.
All right. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The testifiers here, of course, we have a lot of different options, a lot of different ways that we could pull triggers to get to point, and you have enough data now to prepare fiscal notes based on whatever levers we decide to pull, but we don't have enough modeling to know which ones might work, but maybe you do on your end. But it there are a lot of decisions that have to be made kind of in a vacuum with this, and I keep hearing, even though I keep trying to quell the chance for a short session, but I keep hearing that we may have a shorter session this year, and if we can't get to a resolution or if the legislature doesn't pass anything that directs you to move forward with this, could the department go ahead and be in contact with CMS about altering the waiver, or have you talked to CMS about what a waiver might look like?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, the department does not have in hand today all of the decisions that would be necessary to submit a complete waiver, in our view. We have had some conversations with CMS, but I think understanding which road the state would want to move down would help us provide more clarity to our federal colleagues and have better information there. I think it was a smart choice by the legislature last year to give us the authority to seek a waiver, but I don't think we have enough information about what the content of that waiver would look like to allow us to perform the 10-year actuarial and economic analyses that are part of a waiver submission. So we have the authority to do that, but I don't think we have all of the pieces in place to be able to get to be deemed complete by a federal colleague, and then for them to be able to do their work to seek the to hopefully approve a waiver for the state.
Okay, and just one follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
So in your conversations with CMS, what has been the general feedback that you've been getting from them about this?
Madam Chair, I think we get a lot of questions back, as you might imagine. I think, part of what we said in the cover letter and we said in our presentation today, that I think we're encouraged by the results of the Milliman analysis. It shows that both options, I think, could work. Lots of public policy decisions to be made in order to make them work, but they're both conceptually viable and also would find Minnesotans would find them to be competitively priced and accessible. But I think it's difficult for federal regulators to really give us precise guidance, and they would not, say, oh, pick this one over that or make this choice over this one. Representative Schumacher, our sort of structural market dynamic is different than all of the other states compared to New York because we have a BHP. So we're our own kind of unique thing when we go to federal regulators for a 1332 waiver. That was the case when we submitted it for the reinsurance program, and again when we renewed it. I would expect that to be the case here as well too. We have a very strong partnership with federal colleagues, so we're in pretty constant communication with them, but I think it's, they don't have anything before them, and so until they have something from us or have a better sense of how the legislature might want to move forward on whichever adventure they want to choose, it would be difficult for us to really advance those conversations beyond what they've been to date.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And I put myself on the list, and I'm glad I did because we're kind of running out of time here. But I want to ask about a sort of shift to a topic we haven't really talked about yet. So both the models under this analysis have patients enrolling ultimately in a managed care organization, pretty much the way things work now under our public programs. So, backing up a little bit, this is all about an insurance model, but we all know that what we really want is people to get care when they need it. And insurance often acts as a barrier to that, as a matter of fact, rather than actually helping people get the care they need. But that said, under this analysis, under both models, where people are eventually just going into an insurance product, a private insurance product. And you had said earlier that the oversight and structure are different. And so I'm really wondering if you know anything, if there's been thought about, would there be a procurement process for the managed care organizations like there is now under our public programs? If we use the Minnesota care model, would we be putting people into the same managed care that's selected for Minnesota care right now? And, how that might look for the QHP model. So as part of that, sort of what kind of oversight is actually contemplated? you know, you're talking about the oversight and the structures are different. What oversight would we have? In my view, actually, the oversight right now over managed care isn't all that great, just frankly speaking. So I see we have a phone a friend here. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the committee. Geoga Hayes, Director of the Health Improvement Benefit Design Division at DHS, a part of the team that worked on this analysis. Madam Chair, your question, yes. As my colleagues from the Commerce Department mentioned, there are two models. If Model 1 were selected and the Department of Human Services were directed to take on the additional population, it would require a request for proposal to purchase health insurance to the nonprofit and for-profit health insurance companies to include the new members. I think on the point about the oversight that I think our colleagues were talking about earlier is, as you know, and I think many committee members know, the rules of how managed care and medical assistance work is slightly different than the rules of how managed care organizations work on the commercial market. They're both HMOs as licensed under the Department of Health, as we all know, but there are other federal requirements that are pertain to medical assistance and Minnesota Care or the Basic Health Program that apply. And so these are all choices to be made, as has been noted a couple times, and so there are different choices to be made here as well. But under the current assumptions, we did assume that model, and I think maybe just to add, part of that was there are, as has been noted, there are a lot of assumptions, but all these assumptions are also choices, right? There are a lot of public policy choices that can be made here, and so the assumptions are based on those choices, and so depending on what is chosen will impact kind of how we move forward and sort of the requirements that follow from there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that, and, you know, I would just say kind of going back to Representative Smith's comments, you know, is this really a public option? I'm kind of not seeing that. I personally would call this more of a, you know, it's a subsidy, definitely a state subsidy to help people deal with a very real problem. But whether it's really expanding an insurance pool, I'm not really seeing that piece of it. But, you know, a lot of choices to be made. Okay, thank you. Representative Becker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and thank you. You know, with the public option, with both of these models, they look only at Minnesota Care and Medicare reimbursement rates. And one of the challenges that we will see with that is low reimbursements to the providers. The reason I bring that up is we have an EMS crisis. And the reason we have an EMS crisis is because 70% to 80% of reimbursements is through Medicaid and Medicare. So we have already, and I share that because I was just on a call earlier today where Senator Tina Smith's office was in Barnesville, Minnesota, and I joined by phone, of course. And, of course, we have been hearing the same thing. It's that reimbursement. As an EMS, we have retention, recruitment, and reimbursement. As we know in Minnesota, we have some things we can do around with reimbursements, but a lot of it's federal. And because of so many Medicaid, Medicare runs, one thing I have heard across the state, because I went to every meeting, is if it's through city, their property tax, we'll use International Falls as an example, is we have a small base that's subsidizing that ambulance service so people, when someone dials 911, we can get the rig out. In our service, we do a pancake feed. So I just want to bring to people's attention, if we go down to the public option only, and I respect what you're saying there, Chair, at the same time, these models look at Minnesota Care and Medicaid reimbursement. That is not working in EMS. We have several services. Currently, my service that is on a shoestring right now, Tower, Minnesota, because we're getting paid 20 to 30% on a dollar, and we can't keep people, we can't pay the money. So that's my comment, because these models, this study looks at both models that put significant, in my opinion, efforts on those reimbursement rates, which if we don't have providers to provide health care, just like if we don't have someone dials 911, like last week in Browns Valley, we had no EMTs during the day shift because I was down here, my twin brother was gone, then we don't have an ambulance. We don't have a provider. So please keep that in mind. I really appreciate this report. Just allows you to look at things from a different perspective, but that's my perspective dealing with EMS and what public option, public pay, it's not a public option, has done to EMS because we are running in deficits to a tune of last year $125 million in the state of Minnesota. Rural ambulances is shortfall because we're not getting reimbursed through Medicaid and Medicare like we should. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under the Affordable Care Act, the metal plan definitions are, you know, bronze, silver, gold, platinum, are pretty much defined based on the actual the cost participation level. If we brought forward plans that that like waived cross cost sharing under one of those plans, would we get a waiver? Or what are the odds of us getting a waiver if we significantly departed from the basic ACA guidelines on the metal plans?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Brickwitty.
Representative Elkins, I don't know. I don't know if any other state has brought such a proposal forward, and it's not something that we've specifically discussed with federal regulators before, so I don't think I would want to lay odds on it.
It might be a question you might ask them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so very – did you have a follow-up, Representative Elkins? Okay, very good. So, well, thank you very much to our testifiers and everybody, who, again, who worked on this report. I mean, it certainly is the first time we've sort of fleshed out something like this. I think the real question in front of us, you know, let me – and if people are leaving, please be very quiet. We're not – adjourned quite yet. You know, that we obviously have very real problems in our healthcare system. We have many people who are not being able to get access to healthcare, or who are going into debt or going broke because they can't afford their healthcare. We obviously have health providers who are struggling in different parts of the state. We have a lot of problems in our system. And I just would say that this, the real question before us with this is really, does this set the right direction for us? And I think that's been laid out in some of the different issues. And if not this, then what? Because I think it is clear, we, you know, doing nothing is really not an option. We have constituents in the state that really, everyone needs health care. They can't wait 10 years. If you have a health care concern, you need help now. And so this is what we struggle with as policymakers. And I know all of us want to solve the very real problems that we have. And really, the bottom line is there's no magic wand. And the question is, how can we best do it, maximizing what works best for people, minimizing any adverse impacts that there might be in any choice we might make. And as somebody said here, it's really important that whatever we do, we have to be able to implement it and do it well. And that is, I think, a top concern of all of us. So thank you again. Thank you for everyone attending today. And our next meeting will be Thursday, February 29th. So there will be no, we have precinct caucuses this coming Tuesday, so there will be no hearing on Tuesday. So with that, thank you very much, everyone. We are adjourned.